From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. President Barack Obama is back in Washington after a trip to Southern California, where he fielded questions from everyday voters in two town halls and sat down with Tonight Show host Jay Leno. Here they are talking about some of the flaws in our financial system.
I watched those people in New York, even people that lost everything. When Bernard Madoff went to jail, at least they felt they got something.
They got some satisfaction. Here's the dirty little secret, though. Most of the stuff that got us into trouble was perfectly legal. And that is a sign of how much we've got to change our laws.
For a roundup of the president's trip, we turn now to NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Hello, Ron.
Good to be with you, Tony, although sad to be with you on this day.
I understand and appreciate your thoughts. I was all set to ask you, Ron, about the president's appearance before two town hall meetings and how his message resonated with those in this state who are out of work. The unemployment numbers are near 24% in some counties. And to talk to you about AIG as well. But it seems his appearance on Jay Leno was getting most of the attention. That can't be what the White House wanted, is it?
On the other hand, the attention that it's getting is primarily positive attention. And if you watch the broadcast, you had to be struck with how calm, how confident, how smooth this young man, who is our president, seemed. He seemed to be on top of it. He seemed to be somehow having a good time, even in these bad times. And yet he seemed to be quite cognizant of what was bad about the times and hopeful about what could be done to lead to better times. I thought it was a boffo performance on Leno, so it's certainly not bad for the president that that's getting a lot of attention, although they would have liked to have had more of the sense of those people at those town halls.
And the little gaffe that he made is getting some headlines, but it may not go too far, do you think?
It appears that the Special Olympics spokesperson who is responding today accepts the apology for that as an unintentional sort of slight.
Now, the president first dropped down in Orange County, which is just south of L.A., a county he lost, by the way, to Senator John McCain. He held a town hall meeting there, another one here yesterday. Talk about his calculated strategy to go directly to the people and how effective it's been so far. Interestingly, Ron, the issue of the AIG bonuses never came up in the first town hall meeting.
That's right. I think some of that is a fascination on the part of people who are into the media coverage, into watching Wall Street, perhaps a little bit more involved in the details of what exactly has gone wrong. A lot of people, especially on the ground in the counties that are hardest hit in California, elsewhere around the country, you mentioned 24% unemployment in some California counties. Detroit, the city, has hit 22%. In places like that, people are less interested in talking about what went wrong than they are in how this can be turned around, how the situation can be made better, and how you can start creating jobs again. President Obama landed in Orange County in Santa Ana, which is a particular part of the city closer to L.A., or part of the county that's a little closer to L.A., and which has been becoming Democratic in recent elections. Used to be a hotbed of Republicanism a couple, 3 decades ago. Still, not so much anymore.
One thing more. You're in Washington, and Washington, Ron, is doing something right now that it is really good at, and that is pointing fingers at people who are vulnerable when something goes wrong. Treasury's Tim Geithner, Senate Banking Chair Chris Dodd, AIG's Ed Liddy are all on the receiving end of a lot of the criticism over the escape clause that allowed the payment of that $165 million in bonuses. And now Congress is trying to piecemeal legislation to get the money back somehow, perhaps through heavy taxation. How big a blunder is this for Barack Obama?
I think it is a blunder. I think it's a distraction, to put it mildly, and it is a misdirection of the entire program to try to help the economy to recover. It's important that the president get that entire program back on track and get people focused on what can be done as opposed to errors that have been made in the past. And it's more than errors, of course. It's also bad behavior on the part of some people we already knew were being overcompensated. Now we're finding out they're being overcompensated even after we learned just how bad they had been at trying to make money for AIG. So it's a distraction. It's a problem. The president is focused on it. It's not the derailment of his entire program. And I think some lessons will be learned about how to sell that program going forward.
Ron Elving, thank you again. And let me also just thank you for the many contributions that you have made, the important ones to the success of News & Notes over the years. We appreciate it.
It's been my very great pleasure to be with you, Tony.
That was NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. He joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now, though, we're going to continue this discussion of the week's headlines with two of our favorite reporters for our very final Reporters Roundtable. Jerome Vaughn, the news program director for WDET in Detroit, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times. Gentlemen, welcome to News & Notes one more time.
Hi, Tony.
You know, some have criticized the president, as we just talked about, for leaving D.C. at all when there is so much to be done, and a lot has been made about his appearance on the Jay Leno show and whether or not it's the first time a sitting president has ever made an appearance on a late night show. It reminded me of Bill Clinton going on Arsenio, but I think Clinton was, if memory serves, a candidate at the time.
Right.
Marcus, how big a deal is this, his going on that show?
It's not a big deal. And as we just heard, I think the importance that it will play is one of, I think, character and one of stature and one of calm. It's the image that the president gave off of not being scared, of not being at his wit's end, of not being in a panic, that I think will actually be the lasting import of his appearance on Leno. I think it actually, there was some conservative and some Republican commentary beforehand saying that Barack Obama was diminishing the presidency. In fact, I think seeing the president out and not fearful actually is a good thing for Americans. I think we're in a very anxiety-filled time, and I think he actually modeled the right behavior for us, and I think that was an incredibly useful thing. When I heard the criticism, I thought about back to Jimmy Carter, who you know would not leave the White House during Iran-Contra, wouldn't campaign on his re-election bid because he was trying to get those hostages out. The Iranian hostage crisis, trying to get the hostages out in Iran. He didn't want to be out, you know, doing anything else. He wanted to show that he was serious about that problem. As President Obama said, and he was criticized. Carter for that, for being held prisoner of the crisis. As President Obama said, from those critics who said he should focus only on the economy and not do anything about green policy, environmental policy, not do anything about healthcare policy, it's a kind of a ridiculous supposition.
Well, let me bring Jerome in to get his opinion, because Jerome, I'd like to know, is this a new tactic for talking directly to the people?
I think absolutely that's the case. I mean, he could talk about the issues. He could talk about it in a relaxed sort of way. He showed that he was in command of what was going on. But he was talking to a different audience. He wasn't talking to, you know, news junkies. He wasn't talking to hardcore news reporters. He was talking to Jay Leno sort of as a surrogate to talk to the public. And I think that's an important thing, an important part of it. The whole world is not Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is not the only place it has to deal with the effects of this economic crisis. So by getting outside of D.C., by having these town halls in California, and by talking to a large audience at once, I think he did himself well.
Well, the issue of AIG is certainly one that has been dogging him as he has been moving around, and it's shaping up as the first big potential firestorm of this administration. My question for you, Marcus, is this. We have a parallel track going on. We have, on one hand, people trying to deny culpability or responsibility for the language that allowed this to take place. And on the second track, we have Congress now acting to try to close that problem by taxing those who get the money. Let's deal with the issue of who's responsible. Will we ever get to the bottom of that satisfactorily, do you think?
You know, I think not, Tony, because I think, in fact, who was responsible ultimately, I think, was AIG, and I think, you know, the executives who put all this through in the first place. I think the finger-pointing in Washington is a political scrimmage. While it's important in this moment and for those of us who are, you know, beltway junkies, I don't think it's important in the long run. I think what's important in the long run is the fact not that you were talking about $165 million in bonuses. We're talking about an economy here. We're talking about trillions of dollars, not even just billions anymore. We're already up to trillions of dollars in bailouts that we have to do to save this economy. I think the real danger from AIG is the fact that public outrage may sap popular support for the next round of bailouts, for the next American companies that need it, and there will be next companies that will need it. And if we don't bail those out, if we can't help those companies because public outrage is so great over this AIG nonsense, then that means we're going to hurt ourselves. The American public, the American consumer, the American taxpayer will be hurt in the end, because if the economy doesn't rebound, then we're all going to pay a much, much heavier price than $165 million to some people who did not deserve it.
Well, you're right, but Tim Geithner, Jerome, seems to really be the one with the biggest target on his back at the moment.
That's right. People are really down on him for not stopping these bonuses from going forward. And I know here in Detroit, for example, there are a lot of people who are upset about the bonuses. They feel sort of slighted. There's been this Wall Street versus the automakers going on for several months. And people here feel like, well, you know, Congress got all on the automakers for flying out in a private jet, which they already owned. And here these people are getting millions and millions and millions of dollars in bonuses after they've, you know, run the company into the ground. So I think Marcus is right. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the political capital gets outweighed by the fear of what's going on in Main Street.
No, I mentioned that there was a parallel track, one blaming people for what happened, the other trying to figure out a way to fix it. I'd like to ask both of you to just hold on for a few moments. We're going to take a break, and when we come back on the other side of that break, I want to examine just what Congress is intending to do to try to recoup some of that money and what your opinions are about how likely that is to work. We'll be right back. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back now with our final Reporters Roundtable. And with us, we have the venerable Jerome Vaughn, the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times. All right, guys, we were talking about AIG, and the president has vowed to, quote, fix the system and culture that made this possible. Here's my question for you, Marcus. One of the reasons that we got into this situation, at least if you believe what Tim Geithner said, is that they had to put this language in there because of the existing binding contracts that AIG had. So now they're trying to Congress to do an end run around that and tax the money so heavily that the net effect is nobody gets the money. But if they can do it this way on the back end, why couldn't they have done it this way on the front end?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it's going to work. I mean, there's a discussion whether or not this is even constitutional to single out one group of taxpayers in this way. I don't know if they can have done it on the front end. I don't know if you can abrogate those contracts, which is what we've been told, which is what Secretary of Treasury Geithner said initially, that he had been told by lawyers at Treasury, and that was his understanding before the president said, well, let's go back and take a second look and see if we can't do that. It's very interesting. Jerome mentioned, of course, you know, the big three in Detroit, and the fact is they're currently, you know, renegotiating contracts with the United Auto Workers. Those were contracts that existed on, you know, work, but they're going to be changed. So I really do worry, though, about, you know, if we abrogate these contracts, and will these financial companies say, well, okay, if you're going to determine our compensation, our taxes on bonuses, and many of these folks are actually get most of their income through their bonuses, then the companies are going to say, well, we're not going to participate in the government program. Well, so we're not going to lend any money out to consumers. We're going to keep our own money, and the recovery will be stunted.
Well, you know, Jerome, it's an interesting point, because not only are they trying to negotiate a new deal on top of the deal that was already struck, they're trying to negotiate it in public. Anyone that's been a part of any sort of labor negotiations or contract negotiations can tell you doing so in public really is not the best place or the best way, is it?
No, not at all, because everyone has little secrets and whatnot in the negotiations that they want to keep that way. But, you know, this has become such a political spectacle now. This is about the people in Congress and, to a lesser degree, the Obama administration, you know, saving face and wanting to be on the side of the people because the people are so angry about this. And as Marcus was saying, that, you know, that might not be the best way to handle this. The real purpose is to make sure that AIG remains solvent and can continue operating in the way it needs to operate. It'll be interesting, I think, whether or not this is seen in the long run as constitutional. Also, the battle between what the Senate is going to do, which seems to be much less taxation than what the House has already approved.
Let's move on to another topic. For the last few years, we have been hearing the hype about the death of printed newspapers, and now that hype is quickly becoming reality. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer shutting its printed division. The Rocky Mountain News is gone. The Christian Science Monitor only offered online. The Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press, cutting home delivery to 3 days a week. Even NPR has announced that it will no longer subscribe to any newspapers. Jerome, is this the beginning of the end for newspapers as we have known them?
Briefly, I say yes. I mean, you know, we were stunned here in Detroit when we heard that the News and the Free Press, you know, these papers that Detroiters rely on day in and day out, they're going to cut back to 3 days of delivery a week and that this is going to be a new model. The question I have and a lot of people have, you know, besides saying, all right, I'm going to miss having that that textile in my hand every day is, you know, how are these papers going to make money? The web model is not there to make money in the same way that it was for an actual newspaper. So I think there are real questions about are papers going to be able to stay financially viable with this new model.
Well, let's ask Marcus Mabry. You're the international business editor for The New York Times. What about that?
yes, for so far, right? For now. No, well, Jerome raises exactly the crucial question. As hard as it is for those of us in the business who are, you know, losing jobs or who are seeing colleagues lose jobs, who are seeing colleagues have to go out there and, you know, have to find some other work at a time in which it's obviously, as we've been discussing, this is not an economy in which you want to be looking for a job. In addition to that kind of emotional, you know, painful side of it, there is the business reality, which is if we all were to stop making our newspapers, which does incur a certain cost to make a printed newspaper, and if we all went only online today, we would not be able to support the kind of newsroom that we have here at the New York Times with international correspondents around the world and with investigative reporters who can try to keep people honest in Washington. That model would not be able to be supported because we make much less money from the ads that we do online than we do from the ads in the printed paper. Even today, that remains the case, even though there's circulation challenges throughout the industry for the printed paper. So we have not found a business model that's going to work that's all online. And if we were to try to do that right now, you'd basically see the end of American journalism if we all tried to migrate online only. We wouldn't be able to support what we do as journalists. And I think that would be a huge loss for democracy. So we're going to have to, you know, hopefully there will be a business model. Hopefully those of us who remain will be able to find a business model where we can actually make money online. And then, you know, that would save journalism as we know it.
Well, let's end the conversation with this, gentlemen. We have only a couple of moments left. And as you know, this is our final broadcast. And both of you have been a major part of our conversation on Reporters Roundtable here at News and Notes. I don't want this to sound self-serving for us because we're leaving and we have our own personal feelings about that. But I do want to ask you both as journalists, you first, Jerome, really briefly, where will the voices be heard without shows like ours and others that do what we try to do?
I think there needs to be new shows that will continue that voice. I think Tell Me More with Michelle Martin is along that line. I think we need to find a place for people like Doug Mitchell, who used to work at NPR.
Yes,
he got let go a little while ago, and he had the Next Generation Radio Project, training young journalists, young minority journalists to come and be the next generation. I think we need to continue efforts like that to make it work, because you and I and Marcus, we're going to hopefully retire one of these days, and we need somebody to come and be that next generation. It's difficult. It's difficult.
Absolutely, it is. Marcus, I've got about 30 seconds for you to give us your wisdom on where people can go to continue to hear the kind of voice and content that we've been trying to provide.
Well, my one hope as we go into the sunset is that as we've been discussing, the digital medium will provide a new way and perhaps on the bright side of it, a more democratic way, a less expensive way to have more voices out there, a plethora and a pluralization of voices, because we need to be everywhere. As we've always said, people of color and our voices need to be everywhere.
I appreciate you, gentlemen, for being a part of this and contributing so much to our program over the years. On behalf of everybody here at News & Notes, let me personally say thank you to the both of you. Marcus Mabry is the international business editor for the New York Times. He joined us by phone from New York. And Jerome Vaughn is the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan. He joined us from the studios there. Today, we're wrapping up our final broadcast by turning to the behind-the-scenes voices for their thoughts about News & Notes. We have now our editor, Sasha Woodruff, who is here to tell us about her favorite segments. Hey, Sasha, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Tell us which stories you're looking back on today.
Well, so the first one is a story that I produced last October about the 100th anniversary of Allensworth. That was the first town in California that was funded and founded solely by African Americans. We started out with an interview with Lonnie Bunch. He's the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Former host Farai Chidea started by asking him to set the scene of Allensworth.
Well, imagine, if you will, it's the time in America when segregation is the law of the land, when discrimination against African Americans was the norm rather than being unusual. It was a time when 100 black men per year were lynched in the South. It was a time when most blacks lived in the South and were stuck in low-level jobs, sharecroppers, porters, maids. It was a time when it was hard for people, especially African Americans, to believe that there would be a better day, and yet they did. And Allensworth was really an example of how a community came together to believe, but also to work hard to find a better day.
So Allensworth was meant to be a haven from discrimination, and it wasn't the only town of its type.
Well, what happens is that there have been a history of African-American towns in Massachusetts, in New Jersey, Boley, Oklahoma, Nicodemus, Kansas. And so Allensworth, on the surface, is just like that, an attempt to create an oasis free of racism. But what I think is so exciting about Allensworth as a community is that they recognize that what they were doing was greater than them. While they definitely wanted to have a community where there could be black businessmen and shopkeepers and school teachers, they recognized that their mission was bigger. If they could be a successful community and show economic progress and show leadership, they felt that would be a beacon of change that would echo around the country, that people would see Allensworth and say, African Americans can control their own destiny, can be contributing members of American society, and their hope would be that would help to change the racial dynamics in this country.
And then we talked to one-time resident Alice Royal, who was born in Allensworth in 1923. She shared these memories with us.
Well, I remember my grandmother because I used to follow her everywhere, in the home, in her garden, and she raised all of her vegetables and her condiments for cooking. And then across the road, she had her cows and her chickens. I tried to help her collect the eggs because the chickens knew her better than they knew me. So I just had to watch and cautiously try to reach the eggs every day.
Or else you'd get a peck on
the
hand.
They were Rhode Island red chickens, and of course the eggs were brown and were supposed to be the most nourishing. And then with the cow, I also tried to milk the cow, but I didn't do a very good job as an 8-year-old. And so most of the time I just watched and helped my mother and my grandmother with the milk and the cream and the churning in the home.
What do you remember about the other people in the town? Did people congregate?
They were very loving, gracious people because my grandparents were highly respected in the community. And then so many of the community members were friends. Some of them were church members, and some of them were educators. Some of them were business people. And we were welcome when we went to the post office. We were welcome when we went to the drugstore. We were welcome when we went to the other stores in the community. And, of course, my aunt was a teacher in the school during my day. And so on special occasions, we had taffy pulls in the Hackett home for all the children in the community. And, of course, that was a joy time as well.
Ellensworth is now a California state park where people can visit this historic haven. What did you like best about producing this story, Sasha?
When I go back and listen to these stories, I actually just smile when I hear Alice Royal talk about the details of the chickens and the cows and the taffy pulls. And I love hearing the pride in her voice about helping keep this town's memory alive.
Now, you also did a story about a bass baritone named Eric Owens. Why'd you pick this one as one of your favorites?
Well, I have to admit, I've always been a little bit of an opera geek. And so when I had a chance to book Eric Owens, who just debuted at the Metropolitan Opera late last year, I jumped at the chance. And the most interesting part of the interview for me was when he talked about singing the role of General Leslie Groves in the production of Dr. Atomic, which is about the making of the atomic bomb.
What do you like about this character or playing this character? Who was white, by the way, and I want to
exactly.
ask you about that. You know, it's it's that the whole question of cross-racial casting
right.
comes into play.
Indeed.
Or race neutral, some people call it.
And it's so funny because I was curious as to how people would react to me playing someone who was white and a character of the not too distant past. You know, there are people who are still alive who knew this man. But John Adams, he wanted me to be in this opera, and he just thought it was character driven. He thought I could bring this character to life, and it did. It made no difference to him whatsoever. You know. And also the original director and the librettist, Peter Sellers. And they thought this was a story that affects all mankind. So, you know, whether I was black or white didn't matter to them. And so ultimately it didn't matter to me. And I was just happy to be a part of the production.
Well, Sasha, let me ask you this, because I don't think people realize that what you do on an everyday basis, I know that you produce things like what we just heard, but every day you are responsible because every word that is spoken, every written word on the air here has to go through you, right?
Yes, it does.
I imagine there's some words that you probably never thought you would run across.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and having to read through those scripts every single day, I mean, it can get a little bit grueling.
Anything stand out for you in terms of just the experience of being here in the building, around the folks, and the staff meetings and the arguments and the, you know, things that we have in terms of trying to put news and notes on the air every day?
You know, we have a really small staff, but it's a really great staff. And as far as the work dynamic goes, I think it's probably one of the best places I've worked as far as that goes. And it's just been a lot of fun. It's also been fun to learn how to work with different hosts. Like, I started out working with Farai, and I had to kind of figure out the way she liked things done. And now I'm finally getting the groove of working with you, which has also been a real honor to do. So it's been a really, really wonderful experience this last year.
You've done a good job.
Thank you.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. You know, this week we've given you a look behind the scenes here at News and Notes with our producers picking their favorite segments from their time. Last but not least, we have Roy Hurst in the seat. Hey, Roy.
Hey, Tony. You know, I had to think long and hard about picking a few favorites out of the hundreds of segments I've worked on here at News and Notes. And I've taken it as a personal mission within the mission to try and bring to listeners people who should be known, even if they fall outside the realm of black popular culture. And so I brought a couple of examples of that.
Now, one of the people that we're going to hear, she really is known, if you're an aficionado of jazz, as you and I both are, Alice Coltrane.
That's right. I talked with Miss Coltrane in 2004, just a few years before she passed away, and You know, she was blamed falsely, I believe, for breaking up the classic John Coltrane quartet. So I wanted to know just how they met. And it turns out they met in New York backstage at the jazz club called Birdland during a time when Alice was part of an opening act for the John Coltrane quartet.
All right. So let's listen to what she told you about how their love affair began.
I'd go walking in there and he, you know, he hadn't gone on. So he's just sitting there.
What did you say to one another?
For a few days, nothing. He was a very quiet person, a person who seemed to dwell in his own universe. So I would sit on one end side of the room, and he'd be sitting there, always looking deep in thought in his face. You would not want to. No one would want to disturb that. So for days, there was nothing said. Finally, after about 3 days, we began to talk about architecture. That was the first subject. Because I had brought up, I had a book, drawings and paintings and whatnot, and some of them were unusual. And I said, you might want to take a look. And it was on architecture, and that's what we spoke about. That was the beginning.
You know, Roy, Alice seemed to revere John, and I think it's pretty evident in that clip, don't you?
It is, and she's going to be missed. She had her own thing
after he died. She definitely did. You know, one of the pieces that you've done here, I told you this myself, that I really, really, really liked, was about the artist Noah Purifoy, who you interviewed way out in the Joshua Desert one time.
Yeah, Purifoy was well into his 80s when I spoke with him, and he'd become famous after the Watts riots in 1965 when he literally took the wreckage from the riots and made protest art from it. He did it through an art form known as assemblage. When I talked to him, he was living in the middle of nowhere and downplaying the validity of protest art. And we sat down out of the sun under a canopy held up by two decrepit trailers. I wanted to get back to his thoughts on protest art.
Well, I think it was appropriate,
he said, as he lit a cigarette.
It was a phase of the revolution, and we all participated in the capacity in which we were best known. But some African-Americans are still doing protest art because it sells well. But those who buy it are only trying to subdue their own guilt. And I don't think an artist should spend a lifetime doing protest art, even though it's popular. I think that protest art comes from the same place genuine art comes from. It's just another layer which you have to get rid of to get the best part of yourself. Protest art is not the best part of yourself. It's underneath. So I would only advocate protest art to get rid of my prejudice.
So you can hear in that piece that Noah was a chain smoker, huh?
Yeah, and sadly, not too long after my interview, he died in his trailer when he fell asleep with a cigarette in his hand.
That is sad. You know, April 4th of last year was the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and you produced a special look back at that time.
I realized that for people old enough to remember, this was burned in their memory, and I wanted to collect as many notable people as possible to recall that day when Dr. King was killed. One of them was Roger Wilkins. He was assistant attorney general at the time, and he was sent to Memphis along with a man named Deke DeLoach, a high-ranking member of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI.
And DeLoach then was full of information. I put that in quotes. He said that they had the rifle upstairs in the FBI laboratory, that this was a lone gunman. It was not the result of a conspiracy, a lone gunman who would soon be under arrest. I am not sure that any of us were thinking very straight. We had absorbed a terrible shock. We had very little sleep, and we had no verifiable sources on the ground to give us information that contradicted that of the FBI. And I think general human impulse was to believe your FBI, which was a mistake. I should have been more careful. I should have been more suspicious of the FBI. I was not.
Those were fascinating times. You know, we can't let you get out of here without talking about another fascinating time, and it's more recent. Just last year at the conventions, which you covered both, and you did an amazing job.
It was one of the most amazing experiences of my time in this business. Just to see how different the two parties are, you know, to see all the energy swirling around in Denver, to see Sarah Palin walking out on the national stage for the first time, reinvigorating the Republican Party, only to implode a few weeks later.
One of the characters that you met at the RNC, in fact, was Linda Lee Tarver. What was her story?
Now, I consider Tarver among the most courageous people of this past election year because she is Republican, she's African-American, and she's outspoken.
Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
They were in love with Barack Obama, but they loved Cabbage Patch Dolls not too long ago. They were in love with Britney Spears not too long ago as well, and now she's become trailer trash. He has no substance to be president, and people have made this into a spiritual journey for them. For Barack Obama. They've translated historic event into another Martin Luther King. He will not be able to heal this land. He will not be able to walk on the waters and part the seas and bring in a new promised land.
And Roy, listeners could see the whole video piece by Googling NPR bobbleheads and bloggers. Pretty entertaining stuff.
Yeah. You have to see Linda Lee Tarver to believe Linda Lee Tarver.
Before you go, you and I have been here longer than anyone else except for Devin Robbins, the producer. That's 6 years. We've been through Tavis and Ed Gordon, here with Farai and here with me hosting the show, and now we're leaving. It's been quite a ride, hasn't it?
It has been quite a ride. And I want to take a moment to thank Cheryl Flowers, former senior producer, who brought me in, and Tavis Smiley, who brought me in to NPR.
They both, me too. Both of them, yes.
Yeah, and so I can't get out of here without doing that. And you, and Farai, wonderful hosts, and all the folks that we've worked with over this time.
It's been something we'll remember, isn't it?
It has.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, bro.
Thank you, Tony.
We cannot bring you news and notes without a number of people on the staff. Two of those people are here with me now, and they are responsible for making sure that you and the audience can hear what we do on this end. I'm joined now by Marcia Caldwell, who is our drive engineer, and Shireen Strausberg, who is the technical director. Hello, both of you.
Hey,
hi, Tony.
So, Shireen, let's talk about this. Technical director, so you're responsible for doing what exactly?
Making sure that all our guests who are going to be on the show, whether they are by phone or coming from New York, Chicago, D.C., or any other city, are going to come into our show and sound good and clear and just great on air.
I know that you do a good job at doing that. What's it been like for you? Working on a show like this.
It's been a lot of fun. There have been a lot of different people to come on the show and different hosts. I've been through three hosts at this point, and I've worked with lots of different people, and it's been a lot of fun getting to know the show staff as well as the different guests and having a lot of bloggers come in here. We've had so many in-studio live guests that it's been a lot of fun to get to know
them. It does get crazy around here, doesn't it?
A little bit. You know, when we have like 10 live guests, it's, you know, a little crazy.
People don't realize, Marcia, because you're on the other side of the glass, so I'm looking at your face all during the show and you're looking at mine. It gets very tense over there sometimes for you as the drive engineer.
Sure does.
What goes on?
Well, we're making sure that everybody's ready to go on the air. We line them up ahead of time, and we have an ability to listen to them, you know, before they get on the air to make sure everybody sounds the same volume and, you know, the line is good. And sometimes when we're just about to go on air, I'll listen quickly to make sure they're still there. And one time we had dial tone instead of the guest who had just been there. So it's things like that, last-minute craziness that we try to keep behind the glass and not on the air.
Let me ask you both this question. A lot of people make a big deal about this being a black show because of the content, because of the guests, because of the host. Is working on a black show any different for you than working on other shows? I'll ask you first, Shireen. Be honest, too. Tell the truth.
Well, you know what? My favorite thing about working on it is that you can actually really talk about African-American issues, and it's okay. It's not a socially awkward or, you know, sort of a inappropriate thing. It's like you can just talk about any issue, and it's totally comfortable.
What about you, Marcia?
I now know what popo means. And a lot of other things that I really was afraid to ask, you know, somebody like, what does that mean? I don't understand that. And now I've learned quite a lot about all different issues that I really didn't even know I didn't know about. And that's one of the beautiful things about the show, is that it brings a lot of issues and conversations to the air, it did, that will make people, anybody, help to understand other groups of people.
Well, great. You guys did a great job. It was wonderful working with both of you, Marcia and Shireen.
It's been a pleasure working with you.
All right. Thank you both.
All right, Tony. Here's looking at you.
Marcia Caldwell and Shireen Strasburg. Now, no show can run without managers, and we have two of the best, Christabel and Sia Boadi, our senior supervising producer, and Nicole Childers, the executive producer of News and Notes. They join me in the studio. So what's it like, Christabel, from your perspective, putting together a show like this? How difficult and important is it?
It's not that difficult, actually, in the sense that I feel very passionately about the content that we've put together over the past few years. In terms of putting things together, the actual elements, it's been challenging at times, but we have a fantastic team of producers who've really stepped up to the plate on a regular basis to produce some fantastic programming. So it's been easy, but it's been hard at the same time.
It is, and you really are, people should know, you are one of the most organized producers I have ever worked with.
Well, thank you.
And you know, that makes a show run smoothly when you know what's going to happen. But the buck stops not just at Barack Obama's desk, it stops at the desk of Nicole Childers, because you are responsible for getting all of us in here, getting things done, fighting the fight, sometimes with NPR and others, to make sure that this show happens.
Yes, indeed, I am.
And we're glad that you did it.
Thank you.
Tough, huh?
It was definitely tough, but also very rewarding. When I look at the span of, I've been with the show for about almost 4 years, and looking at, I came in during the Ed Gordon times, and I'm just immensely proud of our team and what we've been able to accomplish, because there doesn't really exist a show like News and Notes. And so, you know, as we close this chapter and walk away, I think we have quite a bit to be proud of.
I'm going to ask you straight out, both of you, do we need a black show or do we not need that? Are we post-racial in this business, like the people say, because of the new president?
I don't think so. I mean, if you look just simply at the population of the United States, you know, the census reports that African Americans are 13% of the U.S. population, and 40 million African Americans in this country. And those numbers alone explain the relevance. And also, when I think about the outpouring of support that we've received from not just black listeners, but white listeners and listeners of every race, talking about what they've learned from the show, and many African Americans talking about how this is the first show that's really spoken to their experience. You know, and that really speaks to what our mission statement has been, to illuminate the diversity of the African American experience. So yes, that's very necessary.
Well, you get about 30 seconds or so to answer. I've said that to guests many times, so
right.
Now I get a chance to say it to you.
Oh, goodness. I do think that a black show is necessary, in that I think that all perspectives need to be heard from, you know, different points of view. And so I think we brought that. And I'm very, very sad to see the show go.
I'm sad to see it go, too. We had a good time.
We did.
We had a good group.
We did.
We did good work. This is the most congenial atmosphere of any newsroom that I have ever been in that was multiracial. And I think that's important
to say.
People need to know that we got along very well together. And I see you in the unemployment line on Monday.
We'll be there.
Thank you both.
Thank
Christabel and Sia Boadi, the senior supervising producer, and Nicole Childers, the executive producer of News and Notes. That's our show for today, our final show, and we're glad you could join us. Cindy Kennard is the Managing Director and Managing Editor for NPR West. Nicole Childers and Christabel and Sia Boadi produced the show. Sasha Woodruff is the editor. Sonata Lee Narcisse directs. The Technical Director is Shireen Strasburg. Marcia Caldwell is our Drive Engineer. The News and Notes staff includes Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Bennett, Jeffrey Gardner, Devin Robbins, Allison Samuels, Zachary Slobig, Joanne Griffith, and Drew Tewksbury. To listen to archives of the show, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. There are only a few moments left in the life of this program, News and Notes. It's never easy saying goodbye, but I have been a journalist working on television and radio for a lot more years than I care to say. And in that time, I have been a part of shows that have come and gone for various reasons. This has been special. Special because of what we do, where and how we do it, and most importantly, because of you, our listeners. You have helped us to prove to not only NPR, but to a lot of others that there is a place for the unique perspective that News and Notes brings. Is what we do profitable for the company's bottom line? Who knows? Is what we do valuable? Of course. I want to thank NPR for at least giving us the opportunity to come to you each day, each night, on air and online. They took some risks. That should be acknowledged. And so did we. Finally, let me say thanks to a great staff of young people committed to getting the job done. I will miss them, each and every one, and we will miss bringing this show to you. But it's true, nothing lasts forever. So, I'm Tony Cox, and this, for the final time, is News and Notes.